Gata on opening the sutra.
The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
In some ways, this talk is about Buddhism and other religions, but it's also about our attitude towards other religions and the criticism of those religions. And as usual, it has to do with my own wrestling with some contradictions in my own being. So I'll start by saying that I always have flinched when I read in the sutras negative allusions to other sects. S-E-C-T-S. Or to fools. Or when the Mahayana puts down the Hinayana. I remember that Steph and Margaret used to let slip, though fairly infrequently, their private prejudices against Thich Nhat Hanh or Dido or various other members of the scene. For Steph, there was no real venom in it, and I was often amused, and Steph was usually mildly remorseful after such moments. And I think we're all aware of how groups over time become susceptible to us and them thinking. And sometimes criticizing is what we do to displace our own uncertainty or uneasiness with ourselves and our beliefs. And though I happen to be aware of it at this moment, I'm doing some criticizing right now. It took me a long time to actually become aware of how thoroughgoing that impulse is in me. It took me a long time to admit that I do this put-down stuff in regard to Zen and to other things, of course, too. When I was starting getting these flashes of how absurdly often I have done that, I began to have a renewed respect for repression and for the for projection, and how deeply pervasive projection is, and really at the root of samsara. And, you know, when I find myself doing it, it was often Dido who was, for me, too strict or was caught up unconsciously in his ego trip. And yet, Dido, for all his flaws, has climbed a mountain, and I have hardly arrived in base camp. This habit that I have had, and is a general human habit, of speaking ill of our superiors is something my friend Tony Hoagland has addressed in a poem called Lawrence. It's about D.H. Lawrence. And literary critics have a lot of fun making fun of Lawrence. And Tony defends him, and he says it's a bad day when people speak of their superiors with a contempt they haven't earned. And it is a sorry thing when certain other people don't defend the great dead ones who've opened up the world before them. So, I don't want to blow this tendency out of proportion. For all of us, samadhi takes a vacation and it takes swipes at others. And I began to reflect on this in the context of Buddhism. There's a question of whether criticisms of other faiths is necessarily non-Buddhist. Is it a violation of the precepts? And did Buddha ever do it? So for this talk, I've done a bit of research, and it turns out he did criticize other sects, and quite often. Or at least the sutras, which were written long after his life, say he did. In fact, there's an entire sutra of Buddha taking issue with the tenets that became Hinduism. But by far, when Buddha raised criticisms, he did so with skillful means. And he did so face to face. And he usually used the Socratic method. So he would ask a member, you know, a Jain or a Vedanta worshiper, proto-Brahmins, about their beliefs. And he was particularly focused on theism, which he saw as people worshipping a divinity as outside of themselves. Or in modern way, you could say that they were reifying a name and giving their power to that name and therefore getting stuck. For example, he asked a Brahmin if he'd seen God face to face. And the Brahmin said no. And he asked them, can you commune with Brahma, the creator God? Well, no, the guy said. Well, if you haven't seen God face to face, and you haven't communed with him, can you say that you know the way that you're actually teaching? And usually, somewhere in this process of Buddha talking to these people from other sects, they experience a flash of lightning and convert to Buddhism. I'm not a surprise, really. Sometimes they did not. And I'm actually interested to go on and do some study about those times when they didn't. Almost everyone was edified. So, behind these questions was Buddha's interest in whether the guy's religion was going to help alleviate the cause of suffering. Did they liberate people? And it was his observation, which is something that we can see even more boldly played out today, that fixed beliefs and internal gods tended, like all fixed beliefs, to cement suffering into place. He would guide them skillfully in the direction of his own discoveries, and then they either had a deeper insight into their own faith or converted on the spot. So back to this entire sutra that critiqued Brahmanism. It's called the Brahmaha Sutta, scripture concerning the net of Brahmic opinions. So I haven't read that sutra, I have to confess, but I've been reading about it. And in this sutra, Buddha spontaneously rejects 62 elements of belief in this, of what he calls speculative opinion, or what's called speculative opinion, prevalent in India of his time. Here are some examples. Those who extrapolate from their memories of a few past lives that they will be reborn eternally. Another, those who believe one of the ancient gods of India, Brahma, is the creator of all gods. Those who believe some of the Brahmanic gods are eternal and others not. Those who believe in an unchanging self-substance surviving death. Those who believe that there is a substantial self which is totally destroyed at death. So these all as, you know, speculations. And he thinks they're intrinsically confused because they're looking outward, away from their own, from individual's own interior factory of concept building and reification and clinging. The same little factor that helped me judge generate my own judgmental opinions and critiques of other teachers and faiths. The gist of Buddhist critiques is that religious figures who cling to such absolutisms are trapped unaware in the net of their own delusions. One thing that emerged from my reading about this is that Buddhism is not utterly pluralistic. Each doctrine, at least outside of Zen, holds that its view of the absolute is uniquely liberating. Other faiths mistake their representations for absolute reality, not only in religious philosophy, but in moment-to-moment behavior. And by contrast, Buddhism's way to the absolute is everywhere around us, not stranded in particular representations on an altar. I read recently of an encyclical, not done by the current Pope, but I believe the last one, which declares that Catholic representations of the absolute are uniquely close to the absolute. In other words, they don't include shit sticks or, as Whitman puts it, mossy scabs of the worm fence. Whereas in Zen, they do. In Buddhism, they do. And that's sort of the limits of pluralism. And we like to think of Zen where this absolutely democratization of potential sources of enlightenment is utterly ubiquitous. So you ask Joshu about Buddha mind, and he says the oak tree. So I think, in fact, this is a very strong element of Buddhism, that the Dharma gates are countless. You could even say there's a promiscuous number of Dharma gates, and we vow to wake to them. And not just as in Catholicism or other forms of Christianity at the communion table. But even while saying this to you, that how deeply I love this view of the Dharma, how that it's everywhere, I can also sense, just coming into that on the sidelines, is the shadow of the ego, which is that delicious sense of uniqueness. And yet that shadow is just that, it's a shadow. And if I'm aware of that, then I'm not going back into that cycle of repression and projection, or at least not wholeheartedly or 100%. So, I also, in my research, ran across a list of 27 ways, which I will not give to you, of the ways Buddhism has beliefs that are distinct from other religions. So, first of all, and we all know this, no God, no supernatural beings, everybody's responsible for their own salvation. There's no surrender to another being. Dharma exists whether or not there is or was a Buddha. Everyone can become a Buddha. The transcendent world is identical to this one, nirvana. Yes, samsara is nirvana. We have suffering but not sin. We do not talk of the beginning or the end. There's no first cause. There's no soul. Meditation is at the center of it. And the concept of dependent origination, everything gives birth to this present moment, is something that's unique to Buddhism. And I don't know whether this is unique, but it was on this list. There's no hell elsewhere than here. But it occurred to me too, since there are a lot of hells in Buddhism, that they are as promiscuously strewn in the world as Dharma gates with thousands of hells. And we can fall into them without even knowing it, just walking across the room. So even though we don't have that foolish superstition about there being a place where the devil is dancing around and you've got a hot plate under your ass forever, we do have more hells than any other religion. So how is it then that we have these beliefs, but how is it that that comes into play when we're dealing with other faiths and indeed contradictions in our own faith? And I think the only answer to that is the moment-by-moment answer, the completely contextualized answer of who's doing what and saying what, how, with what heart are you making those judgments, and what is it that you hope to arouse out of making those judgments? Is it coming out of compassion, or is it coming out of one of those violations of the 10 precepts, the one about elevating ourselves so that we can put down other, elevating ourselves by putting down other people. But it's just as important to note that noting these differences between Buddhism and other faiths is not in itself illegitimate. Buddha did it, but he didn't do it out of ego. It does seem utterly worthwhile to ask the question about whether someone else's religion alleviates or increases their suffering. It is helpful to look at other religions and see where they're stuck, and whether that stuckness leads to holy wars, which is something that Buddhism has at least fancied itself as avoiding. It's not happening right now. We have those folks in Myanmar, and we've had plenty of Buddhists going to war. One thing behind that, though, and quite apart from what we can see as the conceptual problems of other religions or fixations, is what actually is happening with an individual person, which absolutely trumps any of this. That is that person in unity with their Godhead, whatever it is? Are they having that union with Godhead, which, as the neurologist tells us, is happening exactly in the same place in our brain as it's happening in the brains of the monks who are being, having electrodes put on their brains in the University of Wisconsin. So we're not different in that way. This is something that Margaret always insisted on. At their apex, all of these religions are really talking about the same thing. So we've got our principles, and then we have our experience. And the question to ask in any individual case is whether that experience is going to be a liberating one. So to circle back to my own struggle with snarkiness, I guess you could put it, it's not authentic for me to critique snarkiness while I'm snarking myself. That is, the kind of hypocrisy that we love to observe in other religions. In the great scheme of things, this is pretty minor. Another very widespread transgression. A little thing. But one of the things that I love about Buddhism is that little things are not different than big things. So I went back to the 10 grave precepts and I looked at them. This is how I'm going to end it. And I looked at how many of these 10 grave precepts are implicated, or how much of my snarkiness is implicated in the 10 Griya precepts. And I was horrified and chastened to see that basically it's because these are holographic. Yeah, I'm filing all the precepts. And I took, I went to Upaya website and looked at their versions of the precepts. And I'll just go over them because we're not doing Fusatsu this month. Peacemakers through all space and time recognize that they're not separate from all that it is. This is the practice of non-killing. I will not lead a harmful life nor encourage others to do so. And I will abstain from killing living beings and thus living in harmony with all life and the environment, sustaining it. So snarkiness is not that. Peacemakers throughout all space and time are satisfied with what they have. This is the practice of non-stealing. I will not take anything given, and I will accept what is needed. So I don't have to steal the legitimacy of other religions. It's okay that I'm practicing what I'm practicing. Peacemakers throughout all space and time encounter all creations with respect and dignity. Well, I will give and accept love without using or claiming. No. If I'm going to grant the dignity of all religions, then, you know, snarkiness is going to evaporate. Peacemakers speak truthfully and compassionately. It's the process of non-lying. Well, I was lying to myself about my own moralistic superiority in noticing snarkiness. Oh, these others are prone to snarkiness. Well, you know, coming from the, you know, I'm not the king of snark, but I'm not at the bottom of the food chain, right?
I'm a minister of snark.
Yes, right. This is why I love Fargo, because the Billy Bob Thornton is a minister who is also the absolute embodiment of evil. Worth seeing his mild way of destroying everything. Okay. So, it's obviously this pertains. I won't go on and do them all, but, you know, not elevating oneself and blaming others. I will not blame, judge, or criticize others, nor compete with others, or covet recognition. In this way, I practice inclusiveness. I mean, that seems to rule out any kind of critique of other religions, but I think if it's done with the right heart, that's basically being honest and trying to see through things. So, all of this has to do with something with the unconscious egotism, I guess, and elevating oneself. You know, Jesus said, "Let he who has never sinned cast the first stone." And we don't actually have sin in Buddhism, but we do have greed, anger, and ignorance, which come fairly close to qualifying as sin. And, you know, how do we go after this? Well, if we don't go after this without seeing irony in our own contradictions, and if we go after this humorlessly in terms of eviscerating ourselves, just as we might have eviscerated other religions, there's going to be no liberation. There has to be humor. There has to be lightness of meaning. And ultimately, I think smiling and not keeling over with horror when we see our own contradictions is one way of taking a step towards liberation.
You know, it strikes me, not having read the sutra that you were talking about and acknowledging that probably it's, you know, mythology to some degree, that you don't hear a lot of stories about the Buddha going out and trying to convert people, right? He's like chilling in his grove doing his thing and people come to him. And so, to me, him pointing out where people are stuck and suffering is like, what they were asking him to do, really. You know, it's sort of like going to a therapist and saying, no, I'm okay, I don't, you know, I'm fine, I don't have any problems. Well, then what are you doing here? You know? And so, in that sense, if people are, even without necessarily coming out and saying, I'm stuck, I need help, people are basically asking for that, then that's one thing. And the other thing that struck me as you were talking is, you know, in terms of the precepts, you said something about recognizing where people in other religions maybe are stuck and creating suffering. And the first Zen teacher I ever met, I heard her very sharply tell somebody once, because they were kind of accusing somebody else of having broken a precept, somebody that wasn't in the room. And she said, no, other people don't break precepts. You break the precepts. That, you know, the precepts are really about us and our relationship and what we're trying to come aware to in life. And so maybe we should do a little bit more thinking about where our encounter with our faith, you know, with Zen, shows that we're stuck and we're suffering.
There was an interesting book, Coming Home by Lex Hickson, which was very important to me in many, many, many years ago in my spiritual searching time. And his basic thesis is something that Peter pointed to, mentioning it to Constance and Margaret, that at their core, there's this universality that all religions have. But as I was thinking, as Peter was talking, I was thinking about it, what he was pointing to, in each case he pointed to the contemplative tradition within each religion. So Sufis within Islam, and Hasids within Judaism, and you know, Taoists, and you know, and so on and so forth. So I'm wondering, you know, if it's to some extent, there is a worthwhile distinction between sort of contemplative practice and religion. Wars get fought in the name of religion, all religions, you know, and we as Buddhists are now, it took us longer to catch up, but we're getting there. So is, you know, we could talk about the problem being fundamentalism, but I wonder if it's sort of like, you know, the institution of religion, regardless of whose religion it is, as soon as we take out the intimacy that Peter was talking about of that personal relation. Buddha's questions are, you know, are you intimate with God? Do you experience? No one's ever fought a war because of that. But when we make it a thing, and then we're right and they're wrong, and then all of a sudden we've got, and it's so insidious. You know, it creeps into our minds so easily to go to that place of, we're right and they're wrong, and we're better, and we're, you know.
I think there's an analogy there between the individual, of individuals of different countries being able to get along very nicely. Israelis and Palestinians would be an example of that. And it's at the government level, the national level, where all the conflict arises. It's not on the personal level.
So is that with Myanmar, the perversion is connected with nationalism. You know, when you try to make it your a theocratic state, then it's going to, you know, that's really materializing spiritual materialism.
You know, I do tend to believe that, like, at their core, you know, when you're getting to divinity, for lack of a better word, I guess, that the deeper you go into religion, the more alike they are. But there's a religion scholar, Stephen Prothero, that wrote a book called God Is Not One. And the contention of his book was really against that idea. And this is not like a conservative kind of guy, that profoundly it's insulting to the differences between the religions to try and ignore them away, you know, that we should respect all religions, and that pluralism doesn't demand this idea that, oh, we're all the same, that, you know, that we're not all sort of climbing one mountain together, but maybe we're climbing parallel mountains or something.
There might be something to that. I don't know. You know, with the women in the house, we've been reading some Merton. When I read that, he's talking about enlightenment. There's just no question in my mind. You know, but he says, seeing God in all things, or, you know, and it's, you know, that kind of, the language is different. But as soon as I see beyond the language, I say, yeah, that's, I know exactly what he's talking about. You know, and then, of course, he gets into some of the more Catholic language about sin and so on and so on. But even the way he defines sin is sort of not being authentic as opposed to, you know, some kind of an action that's...
Yeah, and I've experienced that too with not just Merton, but with other Christian writers who are more...
But it may also be true. I mean, I think it's, you know, maybe both things are true.
Well, really, the mark of a genuine person is whether they're limited by their prejudice or they exceed their prejudices. Mm-hmm. People can have all kinds of fucked up ideas and still be bodhisattvas.
Mm. Now, they don't come to us for advice, though.
Yeah.
So the one experience I have with, I mean, I have many, I guess, but the one that sticks to me was my parents were fundamental Christians, and it's like I went to a, you know, meeting with, or like a teacher thing with Steph, and I was just like, my parents, and I was complaining because when I go back home or went back home as a student, they would make me go. He was like, what is it to you? I'm like, why don't you go? Just go. Stop complaining. And it was so, it was tender, but it was also so like, really, like, what is it to you? Like, why does it bother you so much? Mm. And I had to turn to that and just be like, really, why does it bother me so much? Mm. And this was my first week back, like feeling like this is my practice. You know, it's just my, like I had koan that I'm struggling with, and like I feel like crap about it. But you know, so it was good. And it was what came to me was that I really wanted legitimacy. I wanted my struggle to be legitimate. And I didn't want to give myself that legitimacy. I want other people to be like, your struggle is great. And that's, you know, that's what I wanted from my parents. And that's what I wanted. That's what I didn't want to give my parents. I didn't want to say to them, your struggle and your the way that you figured it out was legitimate. I didn't want to give that to them. I still don't want to, but I do a better job of hiding it.
If Steph had asked me that question, I'd have had an answer for him. Really, because I was a fundamentalist Christian. Not because my family was. I, you know, was deeply abandoned in the world, and so I found the big daddy in the sky, you know, and you know, really embodied that. I was devout for years, and then went to being a more, like, Episcopalian kind of, you know, sort of liberal Christian, and before I finally was like, you know what, I just... No, this isn't working for me anymore. I was really bitter toward Christianity for a long time, and I still have little shards of that in me that I encounter here and there, but I've been able to let go of it for the most part. And a lot of it is that I'm deeply fearful of Christians because, you know, who I am is so fundamentally not accepted in that world, you know. You know, my right to give and accept love from another human being is, and so I still struggle with how to interact with people that I know see me as so fundamental. I mean, and they see everybody as broken, so I shouldn't take it personally.
That's right. It's not just you.
But, you know, it's hard. It's hard for me to interact with somebody if I know that they're a fundamentalist Christian. And yet I do it, you know. I was just talking to one of the homeless people at Preble Street the other day, and she was this radiant, beautiful woman with an amazing smile. But, you know, she said, this is a woman that sleeps in a homeless shelter, sat there lecturing me for half an hour about how all these people want handouts, and, you know, and, but we connected. We were able to connect, even though I was really uncomfortable with things coming out of her mouth. There was just something that allowed us to still connect, and you have to be able to make that happen, and I don't know how. I don't know what the mechanics of that are, but sometimes it works.
Another little anecdote from Pema Chodron. So a young man, full of spiritual pride, comes to her and starts complaining about his wife, who's giving up smoking, and she keeps relapsing, and then it's triggering her eating disorders. And he says, I tell her just to be strong, you know, she can get through this. She has the inner strength to get through this. And she says, I'm trying. And he says, I can't help myself, but I am judging her. You know, I try not to judge her, but I judge her. And then he heard himself saying, I'm having a hard time, I'm trying, which is what she was saying. I'm trying, I'm having a hard time, you don't know what you... And then, bingo, you know. So that's why just the amazing capacity we have to be oblivious to our own contradictions. It must have some survival value, even if it's killing the people. Killing the planet. Oh,
I like what you said about trying to smile when you do notice a contradiction. Because it's easy to, like, kind of bash yourself.
It actually does have survival value. I mean, in the sense, if you think before there were nation states, you know what I mean? It was about protecting my clan, my, you know, the survival of my people, you know what I mean? That kind of was a... that's probably where we've inherited it from. It's just that we now have, you know, weapons of mass... And we're so much... We're capable of so much more... Mm-hmm. Horrific damage to the world.
That goes back even farther. Look at animals that live in packs, and you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet we've also inherited something greater than that, because if we had not crossed, you know, if your clan didn't have intermarry with other clans, you would have never, we would have never evolved as a species and would have died off. And so, you know, and so do animal packs like that. They have to do that. It lives together. Like, it's both. We've inherited both things.
Yeah, I read something about this guy who was talking about when in human history did we move from clans, from groups, like 10, 12 people, to clans, and it was, you know, just a blink ago. And then when did we move from clans to nations? Which was a billionth of a blink ago. So we're still wired for that. And to quote my new Bible, Fargo, Billy Bob Thornton says, this very innocent cop says, how can you just lie like that? And Billy Bob Thornton says, did you know that the eye has the capacity to see many, many more shades of green than any other shade? And he says, once you understand that, you'll understand the answer to your question. And the reason, it turns out, that we have capacity to see so many more shades of green is that it had survival value when we were apes. You had to be able to discriminate among shades of green in order to survive in the jungle. And so, protect yourself against predators. And he was simply saying, you know, I'm a predator. But he was giving him a parable that he couldn't figure out.
It's really good.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.